Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And did you know that R&B albums outsold hip-hop albums 2-1 in 2012? That black K-12 students are 16% of the public school population, but get 35% of the suspensions? That 36% of black women do not use hair straightening products, up 10 points since 2010. Those are just a few of the 200 pages of statistics in a new book called Black Stats, African Americans by the Numbers in the 21st Century. Let's see what more we can learn as we meet the author, Monique Norris, co-founder of the National Black Women's Justice Institute and a former vice president of the NAACP. The introduction to the book is by Khalil Gibran Muhammad, historian and director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, which is part of the New York Public Library. He joins us as well. Dr. Muhammad, welcome back. Monique Norris, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having us both.
And Dr. Muhammad, your introduction refers back to W.E.B. Du Bois' use of statistics a century ago in the fight against racism and Jim Crow. Can you tell us some of that history?
Sure. Well, Du Bois, as many know and have learned from school days, was the first nationally recognized black social scientist. He was educated at Harvard. He was brilliant as a scholar and wrote prolifically over a very long life. But he actually came of age as an academic using the best tools of social science at his disposal in the late 19th century. And he had a deep concern about the misuse and abuse of the sciences to describe black people as fundamentally inferior and incapable of full incorporation into American society. To win that effort, to change the hearts and minds of Americans, he sought to use the social sciences as a platform for education and knowledge as the basis for transforming society. It was, in the best of times, the heart and soul of the progressive tradition that flourished in the late 19th and early 20th century.
The way you tell the story, though, he lost faith in the power of social science, or at least the power of statistics, to aid in the quest for equality that he was engaged in. What happened?
Well, it turns out that the world was not interested in the facts when the facts didn't suit the politics and ideology of the moment. And so for all of the best of social science that he could muster, all of the descriptive statistics that in his day showed tremendous variety and diversity within the black community, that all black people weren't criminals, that all black people weren't the working poor who were struggling, that there was an aristocratic class of black people, that there was what he called the hardworking, who had various degrees of economic mobility in America. None of this really mattered in an emerging Jim Crow America that needed the mythology of black inferiority, needed this notion that education was a waste of time when it came to African Americans. As you recall, his foremost opponent in those early days, Booker T. Washington, argued against classical training and education, and this became a big deal for Du Bois because he himself was a product of that classical education. But the politics rewarded Booker T. Washington for encouraging black people to essentially hold back their ambitions and improve themselves by their labor. Du Bois thought this was ridiculous because in everywhere in the globe that he could look at, it was the best of the race that represented them on the world stage. And so that was the struggle that he mounted. And for him, statistics became irrelevant to the propaganda and the politics behind how numbers and data was interpreted.
So, Monique Norris, with that as historical backdrop, what do you hope to accomplish with this statistical volume today?
Well, it's the intention, to expand the conversation a bit. I mean, I do acknowledge in the book that there are limitations associated with the use of data presented in this fashion, but presenting a statistical narrative still allows us to engage around the questions that have already been asked and the questions that are being posed by researchers and others about the conditions of Black America. So what I presented here is a statistical narrative. So it's a part of an additional way to tell our story, a collection of pieces of information in response to questions that allow us to engage with the material and to be both critical thinkers about the material, but also to celebrate what has happened over time and some of the markers and specific benchmarks that allow us to engage in this conversation about civil rights using data in a way to anchor our conversations and explorations in the ways that Dr. Muhammad described.
And listeners, one way that you can engage with this conversation is to help us have a little fun with it, even as we go through some numbers with some very serious implications, and that is call up and take a question from Monique Norris's Black Stats Quiz, 212-433-WNYC. She told us off the air that she's got some trivia questions that she uses, culled from the hundreds and hundreds of stats. Do you know how many stats, by the way, total are in this book?
I think it's over 1,000 stats.
That's a meta stat about stats.
Thanks, but
listeners, if you want to call up and just subject yourself to a random trivia question, even though these are not trivial matters for the most part, 212-433-WNYC. African Americans, anyone else, welcome to call 212-433-9692 if you want to help us walk through some of the important numbers in this book that way, 212-433-9692. I'll throw out one number, Monique, that I guess is a baseline for much of the book, and that is 13%. 13% of the population in the United States is black. That's the denominator. So if only 3% of top managers in the private sector are black, as is one of the stats, that compares to the 13%. If 35% of suspended school kids are black, 13 is the baseline comparison. So that's an important number to know, right?
That's an important number. I use 14% if you include black people in combination with one or more other races, but 13% of the U.S. population identifies as black alone.
Okay. And let's just go to Alicia in Northvale, New Jersey, who's calling in and ready for a question. Alicia, hi there.
Hi.
Monique, you get to set the agenda here by throwing out a topic.
Okay, let's talk about the military service. What percent of black people make up the armed forces, the U.S. armed forces?
I'd say 30 to 40%.
And the answer
is? African Americans make up 17% of armed forces.
Oh, I thought it was more than that.
So not
interesting.
Elisa, thank you. So not as disproportional as we may suspect when we talk about the economic draft and things like that.
Yes. Not as disproportional.
I've got another not as disproportional one that I noticed as I was looking through the book, and it's right near the beginning on education. I'm just going to pull this up here, right on page 3. 84% of black Americans ages 25 and older today, 84% have earned at least a high school diploma, compared with 88% for the nation. So about the same. The point historically is that this is a dramatic increase from 1970, when just 31% of black Americans had earned at least a high school diploma, much less than the country as a whole. And similarly, 20% of black Americans ages 25 and older today have earned a college degree or better, 20%, compared with 30% for the nation, also a dramatic increase from 1970, when just 4% of black Americans ages 25 and older had earned a college degree. So 20% and 30%, that's still a big disparity. That's a 50% disparity. But it's real progress, right?
Exactly. And we confuse in our public discourses disparity with overrepresentation or with other ways to capture the conditions of black America. I was recently engaging in conversations with a number of middle school students, and the assumption was that black people represented or were graduating at much lower rates from high school and college. And so part of the story and part of the reason to compile these statistics is to engage people in conversations about how much we have progressed over time, but how much farther we have to go in terms of achieving parity in our conditions.
And some of the other section titles in the book, besides education, which we just sampled from, environment, entertainment and sports, health, justice, lifestyle and identity, military service, money and jobs, politics, voting and civic engagement in science and technology. Stormy in Brooklyn, you're calling in to get a question?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning. Monique, lay it on her.
All right. What percent of black Americans do you think live within 30 miles of a coal-fired power plant?
Huh.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. That's a good question, but I would say 10%.
And the answer is?
78% of black Americans live within 30 miles of a coal-fired power plant, and that's compared with 56% of white Americans.
Wow.
So,
I didn't know
more
that,
of us are living.
Hopefully when reading your book, I'll be able to remember that information.
Stormy, thank you very much. Which correlates with what? Lower incomes leading to less desirable housing locations?
Yeah, there are lots of factors that are associated with the concentration of black communities and other communities of color around coal-fired power plants. And they're also disproportionately, as you can imagine, impacted by the toxins that are emitted from these facilities. Largely been a part of the environmental justice discourses and really looking at ways to capture some of the conditions and ways in which black communities are affected. But it does correlate with income, other factors, depending on where you live in the country, in terms of historical concentrations of black people in specific communities, NIMBY issues, so urban planning issues, suburban planning issues that have concentrated some of these toxins in less desirable areas.
Dr. Muhammad, you use a current example of the power of statistics to start conversations but not to end them in the introduction to your book. It's that black K through 12 students make up 16% of all public school students and 9% of all private school students in the United States, but 35% of those suspended from school are black. But that only begs the question, you suggest, of whether black students are treated more harshly than other kids or whether it indicates problems with black parenting or other reasons that black children simply misbehave more in school than others. So how do you think a stat like that can be used most productively for the public good?
Well, I think we want to start with the facts, but I think the point of using the example is that the facts are not sufficient to telling us what to do or even how to interpret them. So what I was writing against, and really as a kind of caution to users not to embrace the book, but in fact to embrace it and recognize that the work only begins once you've latched on to the statistic that sort of either confirms what you think about the world or denies it. So in the case of disproportionate suspensions of African-American youth, you have to actually make the case. You have to build on that and say, well, you might think that parenting is the source of this, but when we look across different school districts, it turns out that there's a tremendous amount of discretion for similar behavior amongst white children versus black, which means there are a lot more words that are involved. There's a history. There's a context. And we have become, as a society, incredibly enamored by data as the kind of great silencer of debate. It is what we start our news stories with. It is how we lead in cable television. We have beautiful graphics. And these numbers are meant to communicate tremendous value to us when, in fact, we don't know very much at all what lies behind the numbers. So there I wanted to expose, for particularly a liberal community of people who will hear about zero tolerance and say, this is bad. See, that number proves by itself that it's bad, only to acknowledge that if we read YouTube comment boxes or newspaper comment boxes, there's a whole other world of people that say, well, hell, you know, those people make bad decisions, their parents are bad, and of course they misbehave in school. So that's only as a kind of caveat emptor to the ways in which data seductively silence conversation, but really should be an invitation to the beginning of conversation.
Diane and Lyndon, ready for a question?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you. Monique?
Good morning,
Monique. Good morning. I'm going to pick up where we left off and ask a question that's related to the involvement of black parents in their children's education, because we talked a little bit about school discipline and some of the disproportionate rates of suspensions, recognizing that in the book I do contextualize those stats a bit to help inform our interpretation of the data. So my question has to do with the percent of parents, black parents, who are checking their children's homework. So
what percentage of black students do you believe have had their homework checked by an adult?
72%.
More or less, to round to the nearest two.
Yes, so let's say 70%.
Monique?
All right, the answer is black students, 83% of black students have had their homework checked by an adult. You were close. And that's compared with 57% of white students and 59% of Asian students. So a greater percentage of black students have had their homework checked by an adult.
Diane says she was glad she was wrong. Janine in Park Slope, you ready for a question?
I sure am. How you doing?
Good. Monique, another one?
Okay, so much of our conversations have, I guess particularly when we talk about the conditions of black Americans, focus on crime and justice. I want to ask, what percent of African Americans do you think make up all human sex trafficking victims in the U.S. and its territory?
I would say 20%.
And the answer is?
25%. So not bad. African Americans make up 25% of all human sex trafficking victims in the U.S. and its territories.
The point being, again, compared to that 13 or 14% that they are in the population, so they're more at risk.
They're disproportionately overrepresented, yes.
We're just about out of time. How do you explain that parenting stat? Because I wouldn't think that there would be so much more prevalence of parents of black kids checking homework than other parents, more that it would be kind of similar.
Well,
don't know. You don't know.
Based upon, right. I mean, this is based upon the reporting, the data that's reported. And the way that parents engage, I mean, part of the reason I included the stat in the book is because there's a strong narrative around the lack of engagement of black parents in their children's education. And while black parents might be less likely than their counterparts to show up at school or participate in some of the volunteer activities on the campus, the point here was that they are reporting and their children are reporting higher rates of involvement with homework, and the question being how they're engaged with homework. Are they checking the homework? Are they making sure it's done, et cetera? So that was the intention behind including that statistic in the book.
How do you hope this book will be used as the writer of the introduction to it, Dr. Muhammad? Then we're out of time.
Well, I hope that that people who have a tendency to people who look for statistics will come to this book, because there's no getting around them. They are ubiquitous, and so I encourage them to pick up Black Stacks. Monique Morris has done a terrific job at compiling a lot of things that are relevant to the ideas that people have in their heads, and that they take this as an opportunity to dig deeper, to engage, to be informed.
The book is Black Stats, African Americans by the Numbers in the 21st Century. Monique Norris, co-founder of the National Black Women's Justice Institute and a former vice president of the NAACP, is the author. The introduction to the book is by Khalil Gibran Muhammad, historian and director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture in Harlem, part of the New York Public Library. Thank you both very much.
Thanks for having
Thank
me.
You.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We will remember Pete Seeger, who has died at the age of 94, after this.